Welcome to Just Curious Media. This is Let's Talk Movies, and I'm Jason Connell. On the show today, I'm joined by special guest, Brian Beasley.
Hey, Jason. Glad to be here, my friend. Like, super excited to talk about this film.
Awesome, man. It's super great to have you. We always talk movies, Brian, and what better way to explore a film together than have you on this podcast?
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, I'm a big fan, so both of the film and the podcast. Let's do it.
All right. Episode 6. Here we go. And I just want to say quickly that Brian is a fellow filmmaker, documentary filmmaker. We met at one of the festivals, my festivals back in the day, United Film Festival, played one of your great shorts. And we
made a movie together.
We made a movie together. I was getting to the big, so the drum roll. Tell them the movie, Brian.
We did Not Such a Bad Guy, Conversations with Dabney Coleman, produced by Jason Connell and directed by Brian Beasley.
That is correct.
Find it on Amazon Prime.
It is on Amazon Prime. Please watch it. I had met Dabney Coleman years prior at the festival and then mentioned I'd like to do a bio doc, a doc on him. He agreed to green light it. And I was like, I don't want to direct. I haven't directed in so long. I much prefer producing it and getting the right director to, you know, help me along the way. And you were the guy and it was a perfect fit. And we did it. And I couldn't be more thrilled.
Yeah, it was a wonderful project and it was really great working with you on it, honestly.
Awesome, man. Two fellow Oklahomans. Who knew?
That's right. That's right. Tulsa, Oklahoma City, represented here.
All right. Today, Brian, we are talking about Risky Business, the 1983 film written and directed by Paul Brickman. IMDb has it as a comedy crime drama. Oh. I guess there's a little bit of crime in there.
Sure.
A little bit.
Yeah.
You know? And I always do the ratings with all of the films. So unless you want to guess.
I'm going to go high sevens.
I wish. High sevens is a good guess. Should be. IMDb is a little tougher. It's a 6.8 on IMDb.
It's too bad.
Which is still good.
It's good.
It's a harder curve. It's a much different thing. Now, guess what the Rotten Tomatoes score is.
It'll be higher because of the critics. I'm going to say low eights.
92.
Nah, 92, even better. Because this is a classic.
This
is a great movie.
It's a classic film.
It's a great film.
It was released August 5th, 1983, which would have put me at the fresh age of 12.
Nice.
12-year-old me wasn't going to see this in
no
the theater.
Way.
Wasn't allowed to see it in the theater. So I saw it later on VHS in the 80s.
Yeah.
How about yourself?
I think I would have caught it on HBO. We had HBO when I was little, and I feel like this played quite a bit, probably, I don't know, late 80s when I was old enough to sneak it. And it would have been one of those ones I still would have had to sneak to see.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think one of my friends had it on VHS and rented it. It was like, yeah, it was never going to be allowed in my house.
No, I mean, the poster, the cover of the poster.
Oh, right.
With her on the car, like not allowed.
Totally. So now the budget for this film, $6.2 million.
They used every penny.
It seems like it's not a lot of money, but then back in the day, it's a lot more. But now, Brian, just guess what the U.S. gross was.
Well, you know, this is the movie that launched Tom Cruise. Like, there's no Top Gun without this movie. So I'm going to say this was a pretty big hit. How much money did it? 50 million. How much money did it make?
$63.5 million.
There you go. 10 times what it costs.
That is a good ROI. Wow. I'm surprised it wasn't more Risky Businesses. Like Tom Cruise has so many franchises.
Good point. I'm sure we'll get into this later about the director, but I'm sure that had a lot to do with him not wanting to. He did not have a very good experience on this, apparently.
You're absolutely right with that. I think that had a lot to do with it. It was probably, Brickman probably said, over my dead body, are we doing a sequel to this? But you're absolutely right. And we're going to get into lots of different things in this film. It's what we do on this podcast. And so now let's get into the cast. We kind of already talked about Tom Cruise, who plays Joel Goodson, or Joel Goodson.
Goodson, I picked that up too.
I really like that a lot. And of course, he was coming off of Taps, The Outsiders, filmed in Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma, to be exact. And there were days where I believe Coppola and his crew came to our restaurant that we own in downtown Tulsa, the Loaf and Ladle restaurant. I was at school, but my dad would tell me these tales like, yeah, Coppola and them came in here. It's like, what? Are you kidding me? So Tom Cruise was in that. He had a bit role in that. Like he played two bit. of all things. And then he did All the Right Moves like the same year. This movie launched him to stardom, and All the Right Moves comes out. And then you're absolutely right. Top Gun happens and he's the guy.
Yeah, he's
and
a megastar. No looking back. Megastar. Yeah.
He goes straight megastar. Mm-hmm. That's it. And such a megastar that he goes on years later to be nominated for 3 Oscars, nominated for 6 Golden Globes.
One for this role, by the way.
One for this role. So he's nominated for Risky Business, Born on 4th of July, A Few Good Men, Jerry Maguire, Magnolia, The Last Samurai, Tropic Thunder. And he has 2 wins. Born on the 4th of July and Jerry Maguire.
Nice.
Now, I didn't say the movies from the Oscars because they were the same films, a lot of them. But yeah, obviously, look, I mean, he's in how many franchises is he holding up? I mean, Mission Impossible, or are they going on 8 now or something,
something like that? Yeah.
It's amazing. And then Jack Reachers have become a franchise. And say what you will about him, but he usually does really good films. And the guy does all of his own stunts now, which is a whole other thing.
He knows how to make a movie.
He knows how to make a movie. Now, his leading lady was, of course, Rebecca De Mornay, played Lana. This was her first film and her launching point. But Backdraft, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Wedding Crashers, and Brian, I'll Be Damned If I Didn't Meet Her at a Party in Los Angeles one night. And I was cool as a cucumber. I was like, oh, no, it's nice to meet you. Internally, like the 12-year-old me was freaking out. And I couldn't wait to text all my friends like, you're never going to believe who I was chatting with at a party. She was really cool and gracious and a real pro, but it was still one of those moments.
And she's amazing in this movie. Like, I mean, obviously she's drop dead gorgeous, but she brings like a real depth, and there is a mystery to her character, even to the end. Like, you just don't really know what she's thinking. And she really brought a sophistication to the role that I think a lot of other actresses may not have brought. She crushed it.
I totally agree. She probably doesn't get enough credit. She brings like this street smarts to her, because she's actually the same age, but she feels so like she's a decade older than Joel.
She really does. Yeah. And in reality, she was only 3 years older than Tom Cruise. So, but I could not agree more with you. She feels like she's 30 because of how sophisticated she comes off within the role.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really a dark movie. I mean, she's a prostitute. Yeah. I mean, right there out of the gate, it's like, they're not holding back. This is like,
no, we're dealing with real dark themes, and there's threats of violence against women. And there is this, you know, the director talk, I've read some articles, and he talks about like messing with tones, where he would bring these light comedy aspects with Tom Cruise's buddies, the high school buddies, and just how quickly they get in over their head. It never goes super dark. Like, we never feel like Tom Cruise is in any real, real danger. It's more still kind of the teen movie danger of his parents are going to catch him. But Joey Pants, I guess we can move on to him as the next actor.
Yeah, I mean, Guido does pull a gun out, but he doesn't really point it. He reveals a gun.
Right.
Right. The threat of the gun is there. He is essential.
Yes. Joey Pants. Yes, as he's known.
Joey Pants. You got to say it. Of course, he was in films such as Bound, The Matrix, Memento, and really great on The Sopranos as well, I might add. He's amazing. And without that guy there, he was the heavy, but you didn't really hate him because he was funny and smarmy at the same time, but yet threatening.
Yes.
So it was, and he wasn't even that much older, to be honest.
Is that right? I didn't even look up his age.
Well, I mean, looking at him, he looks so young to us, but he's got that voice, you know, and it just, like, the casting was spot on.
They crushed it. They really did.
And that leads me to the next two kind of main-ish characters in the film, which is, of course, Bronson Pinchot, who's amazing as Barry, Beverly Hills Cop, True Romance, and Pauke. Of course, Pauke from Perfect Strangers. Cousin Letty. He's amazing in it. And he has like an innocence about him, and you believe that he's in high school, although none of them really look like high schoolers other than Tom Cruise, but you go with it.
Yeah.
And then I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Curtis Armstrong, who I've always loved. Yes.
Booger.
Booger from Revenge of the Nerds. He plays Miles. And of course, he was also in Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer, two incredible John Cusack films.
He crushed the 80s. I mean, and he's the cool guy.
He's the cool, sophisticated guy.
He has the line. Sometimes you got to say, what the fuck?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, he's the one who puts everything in motion.
You're absolutely right. I think I even wrote that in my notes. He does put it in motion. And he was going into Harvard. He's got his future lined up. He's the smart guy. He's got all the answers. Yeah, it was good to have him and Barry kind of balance out. And there's some bit players, but that's really it. That's our cast. Yeah. His mother and father we'll get to. I kind of get to them in the notes. But that covers the cast. Now, I like to quickly talk about the crew before we get into the beats of the film.
Sure.
But of course, Paul Brickman, writer-director, he also wrote The Bad News Bears in Breaking Training, which is, I guess, like a second or third.
One of the sequels.
One of the sequels. He also wrote Deal of the Century, which was directed by William Friedkin, a comedy that didn't fare so well.
No.
I saw this movie when it first came out, but it's been so long. And then he also wrote...
Yeah, I hear it's horrible.
Terrible ratings. Friedkin is not fond of it, and he's an incredible director. Then he wrote True Crime, which is a Clint Eastwood film. He also wrote and directed Men Don't Leave. But
a very different film from this.
Very different. In fact, this was kind of Brickman's, not his personal story, but a story that was so personal to him that he always wanted to tell, like his opus. And he made it. And it's like, I'm with you. I would have loved to seen more, because anybody who could hit these notes obviously is a very, very talented filmmaker. But it just didn't happen. And the things I read were he was offered a ton of things after the success of this movie and shied away from it all.
Yeah, he's very open about just not – this movie was such a hit. Tom Cruise was becoming such a phenomenon. This film really does capture this dark side that we've already talked about, but also this comedy, and it mixes them perfectly. I mean, Roger Ebert loved this film. He called it the modern day Graduate of the 80s.
And that's that's well said.
Praise.
Yes,
praise.
It is. High praise.
And he was living in Chicago, moved to LA as soon as this movie came out.
Yep.
He didn't meld well with the whole, Hollywood scene. I mean, he was offered Rain Man. He turned it down. He was offered Forrest Gump. He turned it down. And you know what? He doesn't, in the interviews that I've read from like the late 2000s, he doesn't seem to have any regrets.
No, I don't think he does either. I don't get that. It's just like that could have happened. It could have been that. But some guys, like you said, it was a very tumultuous experience for him. Some people don't want to stay in there and have those battles. He wrote more than he directed, and that was probably easier for him.
And he even mentions about taking it personally when other directors would take his scripts and change them.
Yeah.
So when they, and I'm sure we'll get to this when we get to the end, there's a different, he has a different
ending. Oh yes, we will definitely get to that.
I think he wears his bruises very openly. Yeah. And I think you're right. I just don't think that he wanted to take on these bigger projects like a Rain Man or something like that, knowing that he was going to have to relinquish control of how he saw the project, ending up on screen.
Let's just hope he's still cashing those risky business checks.
I mean, he is from last night when I clicked on it. So
exactly.
Congrats.
And hopefully us talking about it, more for Paul Brickman, because this is one of my top faves. And I also, and you kind of made a note to this a minute ago, which I love that you did, but Brickman credited Berto Bertolucci's The Conformist, the 1970 film, as a huge influence on the film. He said, I thought, why can't you present that as a film for youth and aspire to that kind of style and still have the humor in it? That was the test, to meld a darker form of filmmaking with humor. Tone is what I wanted to play with. And he achieved that. I mean, he hit his vision dead square. And I always say like a film is kind of, it's not just the director, it's so many things coming together. I mean, you had Tom Cruise at the right time. As we've talked about, you had Rebecca De Mornay at the right time. You know, the producers had a big role as well to let him chase his vision, because they didn't fight him on the ultimate ending. That was the studio. Like Steve Tisch was one of the producers, co-owner of the New York Giants. He's won 2 Super Bowls and an Oscar for Forrest Gump. Hey, I wonder if that was the tie-in for Forrest Gump.
I'm sure it was.
And then you had John Avnet, another producer who did films like Black Swan and The Mighty Ducks. And of course, you had this music mogul behind it as well, David Geffen. This movie has an incredible soundtrack, let alone a score, which I'm sure Geffen helped and helped probably fund this. So he had the right team around him. And then he had a cinematographer, or actually 2 cinematographers. One was Bruce Surtees, rest in peace. He did films like Dirty Harry, Escape from Alcatraz, Big Wednesday, Beverly Hills Cop. And then he had this other cinematographer, which I don't really know what they both did, I don't know the relation. Maybe they brought one on later, not sure. But his name's, I don't want to butcher this, but it's Ronaldo Vallalobos. Okay. And he did films like The China Syndrome, The Running Man, Major League, Love and Basketball. So these are 2 very astute cinematographers, and this film just looks the part, Bees. It just looks incredible.
It's actually very skillfully directed. I do feel that Paul Brickman and whichever DP he was working with, they came with a very clear understanding of how they wanted to bring the story across.
And then we have to mention it because we've both been in the trenches in editing films. Richard Chu was the editor who won an Oscar for Star Wars and was nominated for editing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So as if the crew wasn't strong enough, you've got this guy assembling the movie and it is cut so well.
There's no fat on this.
No, this movie just flies by.
It does. It's a very tight film.
Of course, as I just mentioned, it's one of the first soundtracks, Brian, that I recall that was just so impactful. And honestly, to this day, it is my favorite soundtrack because of what Tangerine Dream brought to the table.
I was about to say, you're a big Tangerine Dream fan.
This is how I became a Tangerine Dream fan. But the other tracks include Bob Seger, Muddy Waters, Jeff Beck, sure. Prince, Journey, Phil Collins. Cool. You know, and there's even like three other songs in the movie. I think The Talking Heads, Bruce Springsteen. But Tangerine Dream, I mean, Love on a Real Train, the Risky Business song, unbelievable. And there are four or five other tracks. But to this day, they still work. It really took the movie. It's hard to know what element took it to that level, but I'm telling you, it had a huge part of it.
It totally did. And there's an aspect of it's, even though it was written in 83, right, very modern. Like super. It very easily could have fallen into some weird 80s pop sound. And instead, it's so modern and forward thinking. It still works to this day. Like the score could be used in a movie today without changing a note, and it would not feel dated.
Absolutely. I remember reading what Steve Tisch said, that this is not a teenage movie for teenagers. It's a teenage movie for adults.
Yes.
And we were young kids, but even if you had been like 25 or even 35 and this movie came out, it would have resonated with you.
100%.
Because it wasn't another teen movie. It wasn't Porky's. And much like a movie what we just did on the podcast, the previous episode was Fast Times at Ridgemont High, there's really not that many adults in this film. His parents kind of play such a small role that the teenagers are kind of left to be adults and figure things out on their own and make mistakes and deal with consequences. And it's why this movie is just so mature.
Yeah. And they don't mock them. And they are dealing with real world problems of sex. And like we said earlier, prostitution.
Pimps.
You know, what's funny is, and pimps, the Guido, you know, there's the whole aspect of when I was watching, it was like, there's like this Ferris Bueller thing that I feel that comes out of this, where this is the darker drama while Ferris Bueller is the light comedy.
Yes.
I mean, because the parents are gone. There's the car play. There's the suburbs versus the city of Chicago. And then both movies end with a race before the parents come home. You know?
You're right. I'm sure John Hughes was influenced by this film.
He either saw this and was pissed because he'd already written Ferris Bueller, or he definitely was influenced because there's a lot of little things. Now, of course, they're very different movies.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's like the light version of it. Yeah, that's the comedic version of it. Take out the crime and the drama, and then you have it.
As a matter of fact, I think one of the IMDb trivia things said that the Cameron's house is right around the corner.
I was about to say that.
I mean, that's one thing that Chicago, which I'm sure Hughes loved, is that it's the tale of two cities, right? The gritty Chicago crime and then the suburb aspect of these white kids living by the lake. And they're connected by what? Trains, which is a major, major prop throughout the film.
Well, I always say that Chicago is the quintessential Midwestern city because it has those beautiful neighborhoods, trees, luscious. I mean, when I'm there, I have gone by the Home Alone house and those neighborhoods, and it's just stunning. You know, and thinking back to movies like Weird Science and Breakfast Club, 60 Candles, all those backdrops. And you're right. It's got the beautiful city with the lake, and then it has the suburbs. So I love seeing things shot there. And John Hughes, obviously, was a mainstay, but so was Paul Brickman.
Yeah,
you know?
It was their muse.
Yeah, it was their muse. Well said. All right. So without further ado, we're jumping into the movies, the scenes, the beats, the whole bit, and just break it down for our audience. And so we open with Tangerine Dream. The track is called The Dream Is Always the Same, and we have shots of Chicago's L train, as you said, which is a main player in this film, its own character. And then this leads to a teenager angst dream sequence.
It encompasses the entire film, honestly.
Totally.
It is. I mean, I can remember watching it watching it, you know, probably some in one of the rooms of my parents' house very quietly. And you're like, oh my God, we're just opening on a shower scene immediately. Uh-huh. And we have this beautiful naked girl and he opens the shower door and he's late for his college board exams.
Yeah.
And there's nothing sexy about it. It's pure dread. And it lays the baseline for who Joel Goodson is. That part of him wants to experience this more adult vices of sex and whatever. And in reality, he thinks he's going to fuck up his life. Because the very next scene is what? Him playing poker with his buddies and telling them a story of how he could have gotten hooked up with this girl, but they all know that he didn't.
Exactly.
Because he's so uptight.
I think when parents, and his parents at that, very waspy parents, have the one child, all the pressure on the world is bestowed upon you.
That is a great point. I hadn't thought about the single child. You're total, like all the dreams and hopes are he's carrying on their DNA forever. That's a very, very good point. Because he doesn't have an older brother trying to get him in trouble.
Nope. He feels that angst for, I'm not this guy, but I can't mess up. He's playing not to lose. And it's a tough way to go through life.
True. What were your thoughts of that opening scene?
Yeah, that raised the stakes. I mean, here I am a kid. I'm thinking, I've not seen a movie. I don't recall a movie starting this way. I mean, a naked woman in a movie when you're a teen was just like, whoa, you know?
Yeah.
And if my parents are around, then I'm playing it off and I'm acting like I'm doing other things because it's embarrassing. But this leads us to this great poker game. I love you look around the table and you see old Milwaukee and Schlitz. And I think I saw a Tab and an old Coke. And they're using terms like whacked off, which is like, really, that's a very 80s term. But you're right. He's telling the story of like, not the dream, but he had a girl he was kind of making the moves on. And, you know, he's trying to play it off and they all see right through him. And you kind of get a sense of who Joel is right there. I mean, right out of the gate.
And who his friends are.
Who his friends are. Some of them are more experienced. And, you know, he's got a tight group of friends. I like that they play poker and smoke. Very mature for their age.
Yeah, vices are throughout this film.
Yeah.
Everyone is either smoking or drinking coffee or drinking a beer.
Yeah, totally.
Or having sex.
They're like college students.
Yeah. You know? And that's part of the thing. They're pretending to be college. They all think they're smarter than they are.
Right. Then Miles walks Joel outside. I guess they're saying goodbye. And he drops on him. Sometimes you got to say, what the fuck? Make your move.
The line of the movie.
Yes, exactly. And your parents are going out of town. These are great. This is good writing, Brian. As you said, there's no fat. They're just setting the nuggets up and we're just knocking them down. Your parents are going out of town. Good chance for you to, you know, take advantage. Okay, that's in motion. And boom, I love this cut. Now we see the parents and we have this great little song playing. And they're so classic, waspy, 80s single child parents. And kind of reminds me, not as dark in tone, Brian, but I don't know if you've seen the movie Ordinary People or seen it recently. It's also got very dark tones because they lost a child and Timothy Hutton's the only child. But when that family unit was working, like that family looks very similar to this family. You have 100%. Donald Sutherland and Mary Tyler Moore. And it's like, wow, that's, you know, they live in the big house in the suburbs and they're well-to-do. And that's who these people are. And again, like we've already talked about, Joel has to live up to that.
Yeah.
You've got to get into the good school. You need the good career. You're going to marry this type of girl, blah, blah, blah. His whole future has been laid out. Like a tiger mom in the Asian culture, this is the waspy mom, and she's laid it all out, the track and the father.
My favorite part about this scene is that it's all through the POV of Joel. The parents are talking directly to camera as if we are the kid. And the reason that is because anyone who is in their mid-20s or 30s or any adult has had, it's like, oh my God. Like when his dad walks him into the stereo and goes, has someone touched the tuner and is there too much bass? And I was like, yes, I
got equalizer.
The equalizer.
Yeah.
I got in trouble for doing the exact same thing. And there's even these wonderful throwaway lines. It's so well written. It's like where you hear the mother off screen, like, did you pack my mace?
Yes.
And he's like, yes.
Did you pack my mace? So perfect.
Yes. And we never know where they're going. You're thinking maybe
they're not
going
to Ecuador. They're just going to go visit their Aunt Millie who threw her hip out. Like, what are they doing?
But it's so well done. And we stay in the POV all the way to the drive to the airport and in the airport. And it's, like I said, continually talking directly to us.
I know that I'm working with a fellow filmmaker because you went right to the POV on my notes, but of course you nailed it. And yeah, he's talking to us. He's talking to the camera. He's talking to the audience. We've all been in that situation. So us as the viewer are just like, oh yeah, I'm used to this. It was a really smart move. Rather than doing like two cuts or wides, and we're going to see enough of Tom Cruise. It was really smart. I got to just quickly talk about the parents because they also embody these roles so perfectly. For the time that they are on screen, you have Janet Carroll, rest in peace. We lost her, unfortunately. She was in Murphy Brown, Married with Children, and Nicholas Pryor. He was the quintessential waspy father from Less Than Zero, Beverly Hills 90210. He played the Chancellor. He was also in Margaret Stewart's Coming Home. He always played this type of guy. And because it was just so perfect.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the parents. You're totally right. Again, perfectly cast as everyone was in this film. And you really get to see their relationship. I mean, later on, yeah, when Joel has one scene alone with his dad, you kind of like, you really get to see that his parents love him. You know what I'm saying? Like they can be ball busters in their own right. But, you know, they are good parents. You know, going back real quick to the POV scene through the house, I just thought they were really smart. Again, smart directing, smart writing. They land on the egg.
The crystal egg. But they don't freeze.
There's not, in any lesser movie, there is a monologue from the mom about how that egg was handed down by grandma and like this egg is the most priceless thing. They don't even talk about it. They just show it. And if you're not paying attention when it becomes like a huge thing, you wouldn't even know what they were talking about. But that's when you know you have a sure-handed director, when yes, you're like, I'm not going to spoon feed my audience. Like, here it is. This thing looks weird. I'm only going to show it to you. And then it's going to become a major, major thing of the film.
I totally agree. We've seen the movie 100 times now, so we pick up on it. But that first watch, and I am so glad they didn't break that exposition out. You know, thank you for not doing that, Paul Brickman. Yes, it was all we needed. It was enough. In fact, we never learned the history of this egg.
No, we don't.
That's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
All we need to know is it's the Holy Grail. That's all we need to know. It's super special to her, and that means the world, right?
Exactly. And I just want to point out, I don't talk about the parents to say they're bad parents. They're raising him with love and discipline, and it's what they know. And they're probably good, and they've created a great child, a great kid, a great human. So kudos to them. It's just the house that he's under. You know, it's their rules.
Also, like, I think me and you as white men of a certain age, like, those were my parents. Like,
yeah, we can relate.
We can relate. Yeah.
I also love, as we POV all the way to the airport, and this is back pre-9/11, so he could go all the way to the seeing them off. And then we finally see him, and he's got the classic white collar shirt, red sweater, blue jeans, and Docksiders. Like, that outfit works today, but it especially worked in the 80s.
He's the young Republican. There he is.
Young Republican. And on the way there, like you said, they're spouting off SATs are being talked about, Princeton meeting, emergency funds, your chores, use the station wagon, not the Porsche. Like, they're just inundating him with rules. I mean, this is Joel's world, which I just thought was so funny. And then poof, they're gone. No parents. Joel, we've raised you well. You know, good luck. How are you going to handle this situation? We trust you. We trust you. Use your judgment, as she says. And I love seeing him as they part. He looks so tiny, like a little kid, and we're off and running. And so, big man in charge, Brian, his first meal alone. What does Joel make for himself?
It's a TV dinner, if I recall, right?
An uncooked, frozen
TV dinner. He never really gets that down, does he? Like,
never really figures that out. And then he has a whiskey Coke, heavy on the whiskey, light on the Coke.
We're leading into it scene by scene, but like, it's baby steps. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, most films would just jump to him with a hooker in bed. No. Yeah. We are taking baby steps. And that's called character development. And it's a reason why this movie works.
Exactly. It's a strong foundation. So this leads us into, you know, I'd probably say if people think about this movie and they've lost touch, they haven't seen it in a long time, and hopefully this podcast corrects that and makes you want to watch it again or show it to someone who's never seen it. In fact, Brian, A few years ago when I was doing my outdoor movie screenings at my house, I played this movie to a bunch of friends and some of them had never seen it before. And we did trivia before and played it. And even if they had seen it, they hadn't seen it since the 80s. And everybody afterwards was like, this movie still works. I had no idea. So you and I are aware of this. If you are or aren't, one scene that always stands out is this next scene.
It's the scene.
It's iconic. It's kind of a throwaway scene to me now, but yet it's the baby steps getting him where he needs to go. And it is a fun scene. And why don't you explain to our audience what this scene is?
Well, it is the star-making scene, honestly. Like, there's no Top Gun if Tom Cruise doesn't slide into the living room in his tidy whities and his pink Oxford button down. Like, it's the scene that got him on, you know, Good Morning America and all the talk shows when this movie came out. And you're right. It's going back to those baby steps. The first shot of this scene is him going over to the equalizer and pushing all the dials straight to the top. You know, what's interesting is my wife was watching it with me last night and she had seen the movie, I guess, you know, but not in a long time. And the scene is actually quite short.
It really is.
The scene is so famous that she's watching it. And when it's over, because they cut outside and you see him dancing through the window and she's like, what's that scene even in the movie? And I had the same discussion we just had of, well, it's baby steps. Like him just dancing in his underwear around the house is a big deal for him. But just to talk about the importance of the scene, I can remember watching Saturday Night Live, which would have probably been that year. And Ron Reagan Jr. Remember this?
I remember. And then they had the silhouette going.
At the White House.
The White House. Yes, I remember it vividly. I always liked him and I liked that scene. I'll never forget it. That was a great parody. And you're right. It was huge. But I mean, now watching it, to me, that scene it's lost its impact because it worked. He became a star.
Yeah.
And now it's like, okay, yeah, there's this scene. Yeah. Because I've seen it so many times. I'm getting to the scenes that I find more engaging as an adult.
And I can imagine that the studio, that scene is a teen movie scene, right?
Absolutely.
Like, if you take it out of the context of what's happening in the movie, and it's simply, look at this sexy kid dancing around this house in his tidy whities. And they probably promoted the crap out of that just to get people in the seats. And it works.
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing it on TV all the time. Yeah, he flips the collar. Dun, 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 dun. Little Bob Seger's old time rock and roll. And I've read that it was fully improvised by Tom Cruise, the dancing anyway. And yeah, I mean, it doesn't look like it's that choreographed, but he did a great job. He goes for it. And that is it. Like, he's rebelling one beat at a time. Mm-hmm. I had some Jack and Coke I had whiskey and Coke. I had, I messed with the equalizer again. Yep. I wonder if he's done this before.
Yeah. And he's playing rock and roll. When his dad was listening to it, he was listening to classical music, you know, the usual tropes of a teenager.
Yeah. Which is weird, Brian, because we're probably his dad's age now.
100%.
Which is just bizarre because we still relate to Joel. Sorry, I had to bring it around. So now we're having lunch with friends and classic scene here. This to me is very Reaganomics. We're talking about annual salaries. Miles has gotten to Harvard. And I just love this little setup. That's what this whole crew is worried about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, basically it's showing these kids like what their problems are so that when we introduce Rebecca Domei and her friends that they live in two completely different worlds.
Totally.
Their problems are very, very different. And so you have to kind of set this up. And it also just kind of shows like when they get into this other world and they get in over their head, just how naive they really are.
Yeah. I mean, we're dealing with Ivy League schools here. A lot of talk of Harvard. Mm-hmm. He's meeting with Princeton. So yeah, these are very rich white people problems now, you know? And so, but it's all relative, you know, Joel's a good guy.
Problems to them.
It's what they're dealing with. It's their problems.
The scene also shows a little bit of like how Joel's like, well, don't we want to like do something good in the world or help change the world? And or
help
we just
my
want to make
fellow
money?
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all like, shut up, you know?
All right.
Yeah. But that segues us into the future Enterprisers class. Which I love this. I love this whole sequence of that him and Barry are taking this to try to get ahead. And of course, it fits perfectly with the script. He's a business-minded guy.
Yep.
And so it leads us forward. And this quick scene takes us to Joel's house. And they're working on the, do you remember the name of it, Brian?
What they're working on? The memo key. Something about memo.
The memo minder.
Memo minder. That's it. Actually, pretty
good
name.
I love this device.
Pretty good name, honestly.
it beeps. if you leave flashes. A message and then flashes and then it beeps memo. If you're, you know, if it's for your dad, if it's really kill
important.
You.
Yeah.
Really important. I love it. You know, Barry's broken it down. He's got parts and Joel's going to do sales and they're having their meeting. And then Glenn brings a lady, Glenn, a fellow friend, hears that Joel's parents are gone and pops by because Glenn's more of a ladies' man, Brian. He's not, you know.
Glenn's experienced.
He's experienced. He's got a girl here, a girl there. And I like that his lady friend is wearing basically Joel's outfit.
She is. You're totally right.
The red sweater on.
And she's kind of androgynous. She has short hair. I mean, she's super cute, but you're totally right. They're wearing the same clothes. They all look like they walked out of a Vampire Weekend music video.
A J. Crew catalog.
Yeah.
So maybe explain what Glenn, what his plan is when he pops by, Brian.
Basically, he just wants to get laid. He's just looking, because even the girl, when she comes in, she goes, "We have no place to go."
I love when she says that.
And you can just tell how dejected Joel is. He's like, "You can take my room."
Exactly. So they're there to hook up. They're using his room. And this leads to him and Barry. They got to get out, clear the air. You know, Glenn, grunt twice if you hear us, if you lock the door, and then they grunt. It was pretty funny. There's a little humor throughout the film, and that was a funny little moment. So now Joel, taking another baby step, Brian. He's taken out dad's Porsche, even when told not to touch that car.
Several times.
Use your mother's car, the station wagon.
The station wagon.
Now, you may or may not know this bit of trivia. I'm going to put it up here early as opposed to save it for later. So when they get in the car, and I love the way they fire it up, and then the music starts, and then the car stalls, and the music stops. Always a nice little touch. But did you know that that was not Bronson Pinchot in the passenger seat? It is Oscar-winning actor and wonderful director and talented person in all things is Sean Penn.
His co-star from Taps, yep.
He was coming to set to visit. He came to set to visit Tom Cruise. And they kind of joked like, "Hey, yeah, you know, once you get in a Porsche with him." And so he is in these scenes and you can't really tell. And anytime it's a tight shot, Bronson's in the car.
Sure.
But he is in some scenes driving around, which is pretty cool. I really like this scene as well. I mean, these are two very insecure, horny teens driving around in this amazing vehicle way beyond their means.
Yep.
And Barry and Joel are very similar. Neither one
they
of these
really
guys have been laid.
Yeah.
Or Barry thinks boffed and getting fucked are two different things, which is hilarious.
Right.
I'm not sure what he thinks boffed is, but and as they drive by these pretty women at this one scene, he's like, sublime breast.
Like
only
so sophisticated.
These guys. These guys are so cool. And they're driving around. It leads to some pretty funny scenes. I guess there's like a racing scene,
sure.
Of course. What do those guys say when they pull up?
They're like, "Oh, you caught you in daddy's car, huh?"
Yeah, exactly. Punch it. Like Barry tells him to like hit it. Yeah, these guys are out joyriding and, you know, that's cool.
Yeah, donuts in a parking lot, backwards. Yeah, they're taking it.
And there's some cool
scenes. Yeah.
I like the scenes and they're cut to the Jeff Beck song. And I think it's really artistic. It's all night. You know, night's very cinematic. And there's just something really cool about this sequence that I've always liked. This leads us to Miles again, who our guy that already set things in motion initially.
He's got to push it further now.
He's got to push it just a little further. Joel Goodson is doing yard work. Parents are gone, but yet Joel's doing his chores. And Miles is, what's he doing, Brian? Yeah. What's he talking to him about?
Well, I mean, I just love it because it cuts right to him and he's just like, "Okay, great. You've done the car thing." Like, now you've got that. Like, he's like, "This is fantastic. Like, my plan is working to perfection. Now, let's call a prostitute."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. What a jump.
Let's just do it.
Yeah. This is back in the day when classified ads, you know, this is what you would find. I think he says, "For a good time in your own home, call Jackie, 555-4875. And he calls. And I love that he quickly calls and rattles off Joel's address, 345 Remsen, Glencoe, Illinois. Hangs up. Now, Brian, I love the fact that he just rattles this off. And like most people think it's a crank call, but it actually works, first of all. It's hilarious. Like he just calls real quick. Joel's freaking out when Miles does this and hangs up really quickly. But Brian, I guess this is pre-Star 69?
Yeah, pre-everything.
I mean, Starsky's Guide did not work because you could have called back and canceled. But I don't think that was on the radar yet.
It was either the person was going to show up or they weren't, which is, you know, it builds in dread as the scene moves on. He's just like, is someone going to start knocking on my door?
Yeah. So we don't even know. So Miles does that and Joel goes back to yard work. And I've got to say, Tangerine Dream makes watering the plants and taking the trash out look so cool. And it's just that moment, like it has the water coming out of the hose. And it's that little Tangerine Dream. Like that is just dropping that in and making it more artistic. Such a good choice. And then this leads to...
Basically, he's sitting at his desk doing homework and you see the headlights as the cab pulls into the driveway of the house. And it's, you know, the knock, knock, knock. And then we have a nice African-American transvestite there waiting for him.
Oh my gosh, of all... Like, what a smart move to make it that.
Right.
And the last thing that Joel Goodson wants to see, you know, because he's got a special vision, you know, he wants the... prototypical young white girl, but he gets this, and who is Jackie, by the way, has shown up, and Jackie's played by Bruce Young, a phenomenal actor who was great in movies like Phenomenon and Basic Instinct, and just kills this role.
He really does. It's a small role, but it's actually hilarious.
Steals every moment he has screen. And I like that this great tracking shot, you see Joel and he's just coming unglued and it's following him in circles
as he's
calling Miles going, Miles, you got someone's here. And Miles is like too cool for school. Like it's in motion. Ha ha ha. The puppet master's pulling the strings. And I like that they're playing cards without Joel this time though, which is kind of funny.
That's his thing. And I don't even know. Is that the same group of friends or does Miles just have like different groups of friends?
Well, I thought I saw some other guys.
It could have been. I don't know.
But who knows? He might be playing with the Harvard kids already. But he finally opens the door because Jackie's just like, open the door, Joel. I just love the deep voice. I mean, he's got this crazy voice anyway. And then he's so cool about it. He's
like, he really is. Yeah.
You know, I'm sure we could get along real fine. You don't buy RCA if you want Sony. He's just like, let's just come to an understanding. $75 covers my time, cab fare. And then he gives him what?
Lana's number. And he says something. He says, this is what all the white boys by the lake want. She's what all the white boys, which I think might have been the original title of the script, if I'm not mistaken.
You're exactly right, because I thought that was so funny. The original title was White Boys Off the Lake.
Risky Business is much better. That's one, one studio note I agree with. Yeah.
Way better call. So he leaves. Now Joel is having yet another dream sequence, sexual.
Another misfire dream sequence.
Another misfire gone wrong. And this one has Tangerine Dream's No Future Get Off the Babysitter Track, which is on the nose because what happens?
He's on the babysitter. And everyone comes along with a bullhorn. Get off the babysitter, Joel.
Get off. Who is that? It's my father. So, Brian, is she babysitting some kids and Joel pops over? Surely this wasn't Joel's babysitter. I mean, I know we don't get into that context.
I don't think we do, but I would go with that is a very cliche dream for a young PBS
boy. I'll be over here. I'll be babysitting. Pop by and see me.
Or even the aspect of like, you know, when you're 11.
She babysits.
You might have a crush on your babysitter. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
like,
right.
There's just, I just love that it's the babysitter. But, you know, to set the scene, he's making out with a girl, and then all of a sudden the cops show up outside and his parents show up, and the negotiator hands them the bullhorn as they're like trying to negotiate him off.
Come out with your hands up. Get off the baby. Yeah. The father takes the bullhorn and yells at him.
It's just another, like, you know, hit over the head of like, if you have sex, you will ruin your life.
But unlike the first dream sequence where the beautiful naked woman got further away, at least Joel was making out with this girl.
Very true. Now, is that the girl? Is that the girl from the earlier scene when they're in the restaurant? Well, is that his classmate? I don't know.
Oh, it's a. You know what? I love to do my trivia, and I don't know who she is. And I will also look that up later. So, good point. And like that frustrates him. Comes out of his dream sequence
because it's
been overrun by bullhorns and getting parents in trouble. Yeah, he can't even masturbate in privacy. Yeah. He's home alone.
That's how he is.
Exactly. They're not even there, his parents, but they're there. And so he revisits the classified ads. Mm-hmm. This is Miles at work. That that guy. And I like that he's panning down. We see things like I do everything, mm-hmm. twins, short arm, submissive Sarah, ugly, 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 swingers hotline. Like this is, and he's just skimming it, marking things out, yeah. crossing things, circle things.
It's another great device by the director as he crosses them out in black yeah. ink. It's like, you can see in his face, he's like, I'm trying to do this, but no, this one isn't right. No, this one
yeah,
isn't
this is
right.
too
this
much.
This one isn't right, yeah.
And then he takes Jackie's advice and he calls Lana. And this is another great directing note, I would say, that he's in his room, he's super nervous, and he puts that catcher's mask down.
In the dark
like,
corner.
That is yeah. brilliant.
It really is brilliant. It's brilliant.
Like I'm going to hide from self. And if you put a mask on, we can't really see Joel's face. Like, right. that was really great. Yeah.
And there's an aspect of, like, the shame, you know? Like, he's just, like, yes. going to cover
yeah. Oh, yeah.
cover himself.
Yeah. It's well, and so he calls dumb. Himself what, Brian? He can't even call himself Joel.
You're right. What does he – I forgot, Ralph. What does
Ralph.
He
Ralph. yeah. So he's like, Ralph. I wonder if that was a nod to Ralph Macchio. From the outside,
maybe
whatever it was, tip of the cap there, tip of the mask, but yeah, pretty funny. Has the call, tells the address. I love it. It's just so ambiguous. It's like, I'll be there tonight. She's so laissez-faire about it, like, okay, got the address, I'll get there when I get there. And so then we have the music, he's yeah. doing like a very, very, very quick shave. I love that it's like one spot and then cleans the shaver.
And then, yeah, there's like this wonderful little montage that Berkman's really good at this too. Like you cut outside and you see a bike up against the wall and the wind blows it over. It's, you know, it's total foreshadowing that his whole life is about to come crashing down.
Yes.
Because that's really the only thing that we know that he really owns is that bike. You know, he falls asleep on the couch reading architectural.
Yeah. Is that great?
Like the most perfect 80s magazine, and he's still dressed.
Oh, he totally dressed up. He's got a sweater on. He's like, it looks like he's going to go out for the night, but he's just having a lady friend over. And we've already had two dream sequences in this film. So I love how this love making scene
is really kind
of a dream sequence. Yeah. It's a music video. And I like that she lets herself in, which is just like Lana
in 2020.
Like,
that's horrifying. But in the 80s, you can do that. You can do that. You hear the door open and she just walks right in.
The wind, as you said, blows the door open. You have leaves coming in. And then she says to him, are you ready for me, Ralph? Which is just, and then, of course, Tangerine Dreams. Lana
in full force.
The name of the track is Lana.
It is full music video, and it's sexy as hell is what it is. The scene is,
and to lose your virginity this way, you're never gonna forget it. And I like, Brian, that the night went so late that the TV broadcast
that's right.
is going
and then
off
that
the
another
air.
You know, another really beautiful directorial move. They're making love in the chair as the TV is playing the sign off,
yeah.
and we pan to the right and we see pictures of Tom Cruise as an adolescent, as a child, and his whole
so
the whole
good.
Life plan is done. Like it is off the rails now. He grew up. He's a man now.
He grew up, and it was bound to happen. But at some point, you got to let him go. You got to let him go from the nest. You know, he's going to go to college soon, so he needs to. This is going to happen sooner or later. It's happening now. Of course, some other things happen which make this a movie and give the movie its apt title. Now, the next morning, Joel is no longer Ralph.
Immediately.
He comes clean about his name. Immediately, because I can't
go
off this
charade. And
he doesn't
lie to her. This is my parents' house, the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. Comes clean. Well, look, he's got to go to high school. This is his house. I mean, come on. And she's no, you know, she's a smart girl. She has sized this place up. Then ask for $300.
Yep.
And Joel may have been expecting, you know, he already paid Jackie $75. Maybe we're in that ballpark, but it's $300. And Brian, he doesn't have that kind of money on him.
No, he does not.
So what does he have to do to get his hands
well,
on
this,
that
they
money?
Have this beautiful little banter where he's like, yes. I don't have that kind of money. And she's like, well, what are we going to do about this? And he's like, maybe I'll owe you. And he's like, oh, I don't think that's going to work. So he's like, well, I have a savings bond. And just like when I grew up, my grandparents gave me savings bonds too. And so he leaves her at the house and he goes to the bank and then It's a wonderful scene of like the old guy opening the safety deposit box, and you actually get to see the card that his grandparents wrote. Like, you know, so here's your $500 savings bond. Please, you know, use it for your future, basically. And he's going to use it for his prostitute.
Well, you know, I got to say that the bond could have been upstairs. It could have been in his room, and he had to go to the bank to cash it anyway. So that was a great call to make it a security box, to make him open it and read the card. That was like,
yeah. And it was something special, you know what I'm saying? Like it was to help him when he needed it. And
there it was. So he comes home, $300 in his hand to pay Lana. I guess he's late for school. And not only is Lana gone, something else is gone. Something I would say that is priceless. And that would be one crystal egg. So immediately the wonderful euphoric feelings of no longer being a virgin are gone. And he's like, what does he know about this girl? Very little, Brian. Very little indeed. He's panicking and he goes and recruits Miles to help him find Lana. Yep. And he does talk to Jackie, who I guess gave him a tip.
Yeah,
that
go to the Drake Hotel in Chicago. Yeah.
By the way, that place is amazing. Beautiful. Very iconic. The Drake in Chicago.
I guess that's her playground. That's where she picks up her Johns.
Miles finds out you can also get a $4 hot chocolate at the... which would be like an $8 or a $10 hot chocolate.
He's definitely complaining that it's crazy expensive.
Yeah. This is Miles. His plan's gone awry now, Brian. He did not know he'd get dragged into this side of things.
As he says many times, I have a trig test tomorrow. What are we doing?
Yeah. So they spot her. Lana's there. She's working her angle. She's got a client. And you kind of hear him talking like, it's the best thing I got from business school. And I love hearing this little banter. And then Miles sees her and is very impressed. Like, oh my gosh, that's her. That's Lana. Wow. And then they leave. That was the plan. Joel, that's it.
Well, she looks up at him. And I mean, again, she's so good in this.
Yes.
Like she doesn't even
looks
move.
Could
she,
kill.
She just looks at him. But there's also, it's like, there's kind of like, cause he gives her this like little wave, like I'm here. Yeah. I see you. I'm on to you.
Yeah.
And she just walks away with the client. And they're just like, Miles is like, what do we do
now?
Yeah,
I'm sure she's real worried, Joel, that we're on to her. Yeah. But as they go out by the Porsche, of course, they took the Porsche again. Lana comes running after them. Things start to go in motion. She's like, is this your car? They get in. And then they're followed by...
Joey Pants!
Guido shows up. And now we know Lana is kind of in danger. She ran off from her pimp. And he doesn't have a bunch of guys with him, but he does have a gun and he does show us, shows Joel and Lana and taps it on the window and is threatening. And this leads to a good old fashioned 80s car chase scene.
You bet it does.
Classic one. And I think he's got the upper hand with the Porsche, compared to the Lincoln Town Car or whatever Joey Pants is cruising around in.
His cat.
Yeah, but he's actually been in this situation before, unlike Joel. And so they're driving around, great sequence, and Lana's kind of getting a kick out of it, very comfortable in the situation. But Miles is panicking. Guido's going down like an alley and his car's scraping the side and sparks are flying. So he's probably getting more and more pissed that he's having to chase this kid and Lana around town. They finally get away and they pull up in front of Joel's house. And one of the great lines of this film are spoken, and it is Porsche. There is no substitute. I'm sure that didn't help Porsche sales because it was so great.
It's so good. That and the Ray-Bans, it's like the perfect commercials for two. And again, that goes back to what we were saying earlier about the Ferris Bueller. It's like, when he gets in the Ferrari, if you have the means, and I highly suggest you pick one up or whatever he says.
Yeah, well said.
There's these little commercials for the cars, very 80s, very and wonderful, really well done.
And Miles is now pushed to his absolute limit. He's like, I'm going to throw up, and I think I'm going to throw up you, Joel. Like, I put you in motion, but I wasn't supposed to go down this like dark, crazy rabbit hole.
Even before they go on that adventure, when he goes and gets him at the record store before they go back into Chicago, he's like, I mean, was everything you were saying bullshit? He's like, yeah, it was bullshit.
Yeah, totally.
Why did you listen to me?
Yeah. In fact, I think Miles is the one that coins the phrase Guido the Killer Pimp. I've got a trick midterm tomorrow and I'm being chased by Guido the Killer Pimp. So yeah, it's total bullshit. But now it's the next morning and the parents call and they kind of relay to Joel. They're coming in Saturday, United flight 162, 3:30 p.m. And Brian, he really needs the memo minder at this point in time to jot that down.
Because he should have written it down. Yeah. He should have written it down.
Remember that, audience. And so Lana stayed over again.
She sure did.
This time for free. And she's left Guido. She won't leave. And she looks darn good in a Princeton sweatshirt.
She sure does, which I think is his dad's shirt.
Yes.
Because I think I read somewhere that the father had gone to Princeton. So she's wearing the dad's shirt. And he basically is like, all right, I have to go to high school. You have to leave.
But he still needs to get the egg back. So they agree to let her stay and they'll work together to get the egg back.
To get her stuff back.
Yes, yep. Exactly. She's locked out. And so now Joe goes to school. And Brian, the exterior of the school probably looks familiar because, yes, it was in 16 Candles and Weird Science.
Is that right?
The exterior. Oh, and that was Niles East High School, which has since been torn down.
Oh, really? That's too bad.
Now, I also love when he runs in school that the hall monitor gives him like no effort. And we're reprising Tangerine Dreams. The dream is always the same here because Joel is living his dream. He comes into class and it's like, what, pop quiz time, right?
Yep. It's the scene from earlier. He had sex and he almost missed the test and he's completely ill-prepared.
Yeah. But at least it's not, the stakes aren't that high. This is his college boards, but it's still, his world's unraveling, if you will.
He's continually looking at the clock, which at one point actually ticks backwards and he's losing his mind. And at the same time, we keep cutting back to the house and Lana is completely sizing him up. Oh. She is looking through all the cabinets. At one point, she takes the Porsche out and she goes to the train station, again, train.
Exactly.
And she brings in her girlfriend, who is also a call girl. And she's made herself right at home. And the beginnings of what we learn to soon find out of her plan are underway.
She doesn't just go to the train station. She dresses up in Joel's mother's dress.
And the hat
looks the
whole
part. Doesn't even have to do it, but does it because why not? Live the life.
Why not?
When does she get this? She plays roles in life. This is her job. She's jumping in a Porsche. She has no care in the world, man.
That's completely
so,
true.
So, he's a mark and, he has reason to be concerned, but he's not even seeing that. He's just focused on the ache, He's very short-sighted. I like that there's a scene where he's wrestling Miles. And
it's so good.
And it's like, that's the scene also in other movies, like 16 Candles, there's scenes where they're wrestling and he's saying, who else you tell? Don't tell anybody. And of course he's told people because Miles is like, hey, this is going on at Joel's house. And not only has he told people, he took Glenn to his house after school and beat Joel there somehow because Glenn has gone inside and met Vicky. And Joel's like, get out of the house. What's going on here? He's kind of concerned, I guess, that he had hooked up with Lana, but he hadn't. And so, here's our guy, Glenn. Hey, this guy's already been laid twice in this movie.
Yes.
At Joel's house.
At his house.
Maybe in his room both times for all we know.
Probably. But it also is a great little scene too, because we immediately see that he cares for Lana. Even though he wants her out of his house and out of his life, when he sees Glenn and he's like, oh my God, please tell me you didn't sleep with her.
Yeah.
He's a little jealous and she wouldn't do that to Joel. So,
and maybe part of it was because there's some emotional connection there, but it's also like,
100%.
But that's like his first hookup and it's going to be diminished if Glenn also slept with her.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So it's,
even though she's a prostitute.
Yeah, exactly. It would still hurt. But Joel steps up and just says, he kicks him out. He just, it's too much. This has pushed it too far. Her and Vicky. And so, he kicks him out. You got to go. I need some normalcy. Gets back to what Joel does. He's lifting weights on his bed. And then he hears some commotion outside.
But before we get one wrinkle, yep. when he walks into the house and meets Vicky, she tries to hand him some money, which is and she goes, what is
the house?
10%.
The house.
You're the house. The house always gets paid, which is the whole con.
Yes.
We don't know it at the time, but that is what's about to be laid upon him.
Brian. And he wouldn't take it. He would not take it.
He just wants them out of his house. Take your dresses and get out.
So he's lifting weights and there's commotion outside. And what's going on?
Guido has tracked them down and he is there to get Lana and Vicky and take them home.
And this is when Joel starts to step up. He's no longer this shy boy. He stops Guido from going in his house.
And it's actually pretty impressive.
Very much. Because this guy pulled a gun the night before. Joey Pants is such a good actor that he's threatening, but not too threatening because he's funny
and he's charming.
Yeah. And time of your life, huh, kid? You know, he knows, he sized Joel up as well. Here's a kid out of his element, rich kid from the burbs. Lana's taking cover. Surely he's not running these girls. So he's not coming too hot at him, but he stood up for himself. Like, you got to go.
And there's another really great director's moment where the girls poke their head out of the second story window and they're yelling at Guido. And you look over Joel's shoulder and back on the street are three kids, like little kids. Yes. And they're watching it. And I think there's an aspect of him like I can't let this get out of hand or all the neighbors. You know what I'm saying? Yes. Like there's appearances within this neighborhood that he has to keep up. But it's such a great little moment. And it's perfect that it's children and not adults.
It's just enough to know that there's a little bit more tension here and I got to get this thing done.
And that these three characters, Guido, Vicky, and Lana, are in a different world. They're literally in a different
world. Even these little kids recognize something's wrong.
Yep. Yeah. They don't belong.
I like that Guido says, in a sluggish economy, never ever fuck with another man's livelihood.
Yeah. Which is another, you know, jab at, you know, the Reagan administration.
Exactly.
You know, like, while the economy for the white people here in the suburbs may be great, the shit that's happening in the inner city is not fantastic.
Yeah. So he leaves, and now Joel, Lana, and Vicky are having another unfrozen dinner, which Joel's becoming very accustomed to in this reality of no parents.
That's his go-to meal when he has guests over. Everyone gets a frozen TV dinner. Yeah.
And the plan is like one night. Just one night. We'll get things worked out. We're out of here tomorrow. Bada bing, bada boom.
Like you said, it's that short-sightedness. Just get me that egg and we'll make everything right.
So as Joel is studying and Lana comes in and she asks what he's doing. And I like that he says free enterprise. Which is actually the class's future enterprise, but whatever, maybe it's a slip of the tongue. It also kind of means the same thing, but I was like, wait, that's not the same class, but whatever. He explains what it is to Lana, which is so, you know, I love that he's thinking about business, but here he is about to be thrust upon a whole new business idea because Lana will be bringing that to the forefront very soon. But she invites him to go to do what, Brian? What does she invite Joel to go do?
She basically lays very seductively on the bed and be like, Joel, do you want to get high with me and Vicky and then go get some ice cream? And again, you know, she has a plan and this is another baby step for Joel. Now he is using drugs, which, you know, obviously in parts of the United States still today, marijuana is illegal and very much so in 1983. Yeah. So man, when she lays on that bed, that's a beautiful like close up of her kind of laying into the shot.
I know.
It's and it's just like, yeah, I want to go use drugs.
Well, she was 100%. Very seductive and she knew use it.
Yeah. And you know, he gets up when he says, yeah, I want to go get some ice cream. He doesn't say, I want to use pot. But he's like, I want to go get some ice cream. He stands up. He kind of like walks by her like she's a shark.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't want to get too close to her as he walks out the room.
Well, this concept of having a pseudo girlfriend for a night or two is very new to Joel. I wouldn't say he's even had a serious relationship yet. So it's just like, oh, you know, he's tiptoeing around it, literally.
Yeah, literally.
You know, so, and maybe he's been high before, but I love to see him and Barry high. They're so stoned that he can't even like eat his ice cream. And you know,
he's got ice cream on his nose and he's completely out of his element.
And I like that Barry's joined him. So Barry goes off with Vicky on a walk.
Yeah. So they're by the lake. They've taken the Porsche out by the lake.
Lake Michigan. And then Joel and Lana talk. And right here, I mean, Brian, she lays it out. She wants to co-mingle their friends for profit. and I'll be your girlfriend for a few days, you know, while this is happening.
Yep.
And it's like,
she's basically like, do they all have savings bonds?
Yeah. And Joel doesn't come from a place of needing money. So this was not on his radar. I need my egg back. And this is kind of a fun experience, but that's it. That's, you know, I'm thinking about my finals and my, you know, future enterprise class and blah, 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 blah.
His future.
I'm thinking about my future. And
they're both thinking about their future.
Right. Oh, yeah. She can make bank with if this
works. They have very different futures. They're good. They're on different tracks.
Then the conversation continues, Brian.
Yeah. And basically, he rejects it. He's like, no, that's not going to happen. I just need you to get me the egg and I need to get my life back to normal. Right. And she's so amazing in this part, Rebecca. She gets rejected and she just kind of goes into herself. Yeah. And it's not an emotional thing. What's happening is, what's my next move?
Yeah.
Because she's smart. She's the smartest person in the film. Yeah. And that brings them back. She walks back to the car. Yeah. She opens the door to get her purse. Yeah. And you kind of think she's leaving. And here's the thing. And this is up for debate. I think that she intentionally, when she reaches over to get the purse, she puts the car into neutral, because it's the only thing that she can do is, if I can somehow hurt this car, I will put him behind the eight ball. Now, it isn't played that way. They definitely don't play it that way.
Mind blown here, Brian. I don't know. I never, ever, ever thought of it that way. But
yeah, and they don't play it that way. They don't play it like she like stops and looks at it. She just reaches, but she's been rejected on the dock. Her whole plan is in jeopardy, and she does the one thing she can do, and that's to hurt the car. So she puts it in neutral, and they go around. They sit on the cover on the front of the car, and then he starts asking her
like, "How come you're not in school?"
And it's all yes or no's. Like, she's not giving anything. She's very guarded. Yeah. And he's like, "Well, if you're going to be my girlfriend, you know," basically what he's saying is like, "If you're supposed to be my girlfriend, how's this work when you won't tell me anything? You know everything about me."
He could be more subtle. He was grilling her pretty hard. How come you're not in school? Like, really, talking down to her. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And at that moment, we find out, you know, on the dock there, we actually do find out that they're the same age. She says, we're the same age. How do your friends have this money? My friends don't have this kind of money. Yeah. You know, when they're back on their car talking and he's grilling her with questions, we really do kind of come to find out that, like, she left home because her stepdad kept hitting on her. I mean, that's most likely code that she was abused. Yep. You know what I'm saying? Yep. That pushed her into the lot. But she was smarter and was like, I can use this to get to a better part of my life, you know?
Absolutely. And she doesn't feel sorry for herself.
But no, she does not feel sorry for herself.
And that's great. Or her circumstances. She just doesn't want him to talk down to her. This is new for Joel. He's probably never had a conversation like this with anybody.
Sure. And he's never talked to a girl openly like this. So he's always stepping on minefields with her. And again, she is the smartest character. Yeah. So she's laying them down for him to step on, and reacts perfectly. You know, when you're infatuated with someone the way he is, he wants to make her happy.
She's making the best of her life. And future Lana, whatever it is, I could see that she comes out of this and she gets ahead in life because she is smart and business savvy. But I don't believe that she did that intentionally. Just so the audience may be aware, knocks it out of park into neutral, as you just said. But all we see is like her grabbing her purse. I don't think it was on purpose.
It's very subtle either way. Yeah. I mean, it's up for debate.
It's up for debate. It's a really good point. And if we ever talk to
him. They don't play it like she's doing it on purpose.
If we ever talk to Paul Brickman, I will definitely pose the question. But I don't think it was. But as she walks away and he gets off the car starts to roll because it's on an incline. Like a little hill, and then there's a pier, but it starts to roll and he runs over to the car door, the driver's side door, and it's locked. So keys are inside, it's locked.
So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
The door was unlocked when she reached in to get her purse. So now the door's locked. I think that goes towards my theory of her doing it on purpose.
That just seems so malicious. I think it's a movie thing where it's like, car door just locked. I don't think Lana was coming into play there.
It's only locked for one person, and that's Joel.
Yeah. She just closed it, and it just like it locked itself. But whatever, it's starting to roll, and Joel realizes what's happening. It's actually really well done. He's trying to keep it going. Of course, movie magic. It not just rolls down the hill, it rolls onto this old wooden pier, if you will. And not just that, Joel's now on top of the hood And it's
begging it to stop.
Begging it to stop. And it rolls all the way to the edge of the pier and then finally stops at the end.
And he's saved.
And he's saved. But this is an old pier, as I just said. And it buckles to the weight of the car. By this time, Joel's gotten off and he's kind of like shimmying his way around the car. And you can kind of tell it's no longer, this is pre-Cruise doing all of his own stunts.
That's true.
So the guy jumps off and the thing just goes down. And
And you can even tell it's a stunt car.
Yeah.
Like the car is kind of banged up on the hood.
But still, this is, the plot has thickened.
Yes. Now he's fucked.
I am like, in trouble.
He, like Cameron before him, or after him, I should say,
yes.
The car is destroyed. And now he has to figure out how to fix it.
Again, this is good cuts. Like you hear like Barry and Vicky, like Joel, and we are literally at the car shop. And this guy opens the door and water comes gushing out with three fish and they just go swimming upstream. And hopefully they were not injured in this.
They do swim upstream.
But Brian, it's hilarious that they didn't think to open the door at Lake Michigan when it was pulled out. Now let's get it back to the shop and then we'll get all this water out of here. And I like the guy that runs the place. He's like, who's the U-boat commander?
Great, you know, line.
That's all he
great
says. Line. And that's all he needs to say.
Yep.
And Joel is just sitting there dejected. His friends are trying to console him. And he just, obviously, Brian, he's not supposed to drive this car, let alone put it in Lake Michigan.
Absolutely not. And Lana's plan is complete. Like we know he has no way out.
Because Joel now has a crisis and needs money. And his bonds have a limit. And I don't, it's not going to cover this.
Can't fix a port.
No, he doesn't have enough stock. He's going to trade in to fix this.
And we learned earlier from the parents that he was not insured on the car. So it's all coming out of his end.
So now Joel is at school and he's late. I mean, his dream is a reality again. He's missing school and he goes in and there's Nurse Bullock who... Brian, she is so good in this role as this nurse.
Oh, excellent.
And never says one word.
Nope, it's all facial expression.
Facial and like gives him the bye-bye sign and then he just can't take it because she's running, unexcused, and that's going to make him, fail some tests. It's going to throw his GPA. Everything's going down for Joel.
Yep.
So what does he do? It's already bad enough. He's going to get incomplete on some classes, but he goes further.
Puts hands on her.
He grabs her lapel. Can't grab a teacher. Can't grab a nurse.
Can't touch.
Can't do it. He gets suspended for 5 days.
And what's amazing is he tells her the truth. He goes,
total
a prostitute came to my house. I put my dad's car in Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
I have to get it. Like, he doesn't make up lies. Yeah. He literally tells her what happens and she thinks he's lying because it's so absurd.
It's so absurd. And his parents, he knows they're going to find out about this.
Yep.
This can't be swept under the rug on both accounts. He's dead man walking.
He sure is.
So he goes outside. He is even more distraught than he was at the body shop. And he needs a bike. And I give him a bike. Of course, he didn't have his bike because for whatever reason. And so Glenn, give him your bike. So he takes the bike.
Give him your bike, Glenn.
Come on, dude. You've only been laid twice at his house in the last couple of days.
Yeah, come on, Glenn.
So he gets on the bike and he just rides like crazy. And we have Tangerine Dreams. The first time we hear Love on a Real Train, the Risky Business song. And he's going so fast, Brian, that the next time we see him, he's getting out of a cab. And he's at Lana's house. Where's the bike? What happened to Glenn's bike?
That's so funny. I didn't really put it together that he wasn't selling the bike, really.
So he gets there, he runs in. And Brian, this is a great shot. When he comes in, these views of the city and her apartment, they embrace the camera's going around. I think you even see Vicky kind of in the background.
Yeah, no, it stops and she's like leaning up against the doorway. It's really well crafted. Yeah.
One of those cinematographers, or both of them. Props to both of you. Now it's a new day and a new plan. And Lana's idea is going into motion.
And we slip into the voiceover of them two sitting at her little breakfast nook.
Yeah.
And he, and I think this is a really important line. He talks about her mind. He's like, he's fallen in love with her body. That was easy. He did that the moment he saw her. But now he's falling in love with her mind and the way she thinks and the way, you know, she's crunching through these numbers. And he's just like, oh my God, like I can fix everything that's wrong in my life if I just stick with her. Not knowing that all the problems are because of her, but I thought that was a really well, a really nice touch both in the script and in the direction to be like, I really am falling in love with her, which is what's happening. I fall in love with her body and now I'm falling in love with the whole person.
Yeah. To see her, she's street smart. She's out there doing it. He's reading about it in school and learning about 100%. Future enterprises. And it's like, here it is at work. Wow. She's helping him like take huge steps. Like, wow, I do know some stuff too. I have talent. Like he's gaining confidence by just being around her. Yes, his life is in shambles, but you know what? He needed to shake the tree a little bit. We needed to shake Joel up just a smidge. It's going to happen sooner or later. And yeah, he sees like, wow, this deficit is achievable. Plus she's wins. You know, we could all win here. And so yeah, what do we got to do? So they go out and I like that they have to go to a rental shop, Mr. Rents is the name of it, to go bed shopping. You can't just order beds. You've got to go there and test the merchandise to make sure their beds you're going to need for the brothel.
And she tests them out very well. He's looking on, the salesman's looking on, she's laying on the bed, she's giving Tom Cruise the come hither look, and the salesman's like nudging him with his shoulder like, dude, you're one lucky son of a bitch, kid.
That guy didn't say anything either. That was just a great moment with him.
Yeah.
He looked the part. He looks at the girl, sizes it up, and is like, dude, get in there. He gives him that great nudge. You could have done that so many ways. Like, ma'am, you're not supposed to lay on the beds, but this movie, like, so understated. It says so much through the visuals. So they're getting the beds. She knows what they're going to need. And then we cut to another great shot in the movie, a shot that I never grow tired of seeing, but it's the endless supply of ladies arriving as Barry answers the door to the classic Muddy Waters track, Mannish Boy, I'm a Man, which also just like says it all. And then he opens the door and he keeps trying to close it. Like Barry's so good in that moment. Like
more girls coming, more girls.
So many girls, I've lost count. So now the stage is set. We've got the beds, we got the ladies, and then we see Joel go into sales mode.
That's right.
You know, he is now a different guy. He's donned the Ray-Bans. He's now got this cool energy about him.
He's smoking.
Like whatever Miles was at earlier in this movie, he's far surpassed that.
He is what Miles thought he was.
Yes. Yeah. He's going around. He's talking to guys at restaurants, laying the skinny on them. Like, now, I love that whole sequence, by the way.
Yeah. He basically breaks it down. He's like, how much did you spend on dinner? Yeah. What about tip? Da-da-da. And what happened? This other guy.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, then I got the solution to all your problems.
I got it. He goes to the gas station. Where are you going? You going away to school? College girls can sense it, man. You need to be experienced.
You like, gotta be experienced.
And everyone's like, oh, okay. And then two guys are watching
Jazzercise
on a TV, like outside of an electronics store, comes up, puts his arm on them. Like he's it, man. Joel is at a whole new level.
He's basically, you know, at the beginning of the film, we see him with the sunglasses on while he's doing yard work, and he has turned into the character he always kind of envisions himself to be.
Exactly. So now it's party time, and Joel's house is hopping, Brian.
It is bumping, baby.
I love that the whole neighborhood is just full of cars. They're coming up on mopeds. They're coming in. Like, this town of Glencoe or Highland Park or wherever it is, these guys need to get laid. They've all sitting on bonds, and they need to get laid.
Yeah, and they have that scene of them going through the revolving doors into the bank and then coming back out with their cash in hand.
I think she even said that. Your people have a lot of bonds. You know, it's so good. And now we see Miles. He's more adult than ever. I believe he's smoking a pipe.
Yes, he's got his pipe. And now he's above it. I'm above it.
I don't have to pay for it. I don't, you know.
I get it for free. We get to see that he's just as insecure as every other character.
And Jill handles him so perfectly. It's like, you know, whatever you want to do, Miles. It's no big deal. Whatever you want to do.
That's right. Whatever you want to do, Miles.
Whatever you want to do. Well, remember that Princeton meeting that his father put in motion?
Should have written it down.
On the memo. So who shows up?
the dean of admissions for Princeton shows up in his briefcase and his tie and his mustache.
His Princeton colored tie, no less. His Princeton tie.
Oh, that's
tie.
Right. Very good. Very good. And the look on his face, it's not it's not boding well as he makes his way through the house for Joel.
And as we've said all along, Brian, his casting has been on point.
Yep.
And Mr. Bill Rutherford is played by Richard Mauser. I've always loved this actor. He was
so
in
good
films like The Thing and License to Drive. He's so good in every scene. I've always loved his voice, his demeanor, and he just kills it in these scenes. He's so believable as the dean.
He's very deadpanned and funny. Ugh.
So they're having this meeting. They're going through with this meeting with all that's going on. You know, they've got it. Barry's in there. Barry's the accountant. He's adding the money up. He's got the pencil sharpened. He's like, hey, Barry, can we have the room? So they have this like little, it looks like a den. And they're in this little room and they're going to meet. And Lana just keeps coming in and out, you know, because she's got
she's
like
checking
a,
beds.
Yeah, she's got like a rollaway bed with her, right? Yeah. And yeah, this is a wild night.
I will say this is like, if this movie ever was at one point within the script, a very straightforward, generic 80s movie, this is the scene that survived that draft.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like this is, I love this scene. I'm not putting it down at all.
No.
And it definitely works within the movie, but this is the generic 80s trope of I'm having a party at my parents' house and the guy who's interviewing me for the college shows up and is not happy. And it doesn't divert from that, honestly. Like it is a silly scene and we know where it's going and it's funny.
And I love that he just runs through just Joel's academic history. And he hits on all these little things he's done, his grade point average. No mention of the wrestling team though, Brian.
Oh,
skip right over that.
Missed that on the resume.
He was in the JV tennis club and the varsity track, but no mention of wrestling. And then he says, after taking all of it in, well, Joel, your stats are very respectable. You've done some solid work here, but it's not quite Ivy League now, is it?
Not quite Ivy League.
That's so good.
And it's where we knew the scene was heading. And what is so wonderful is, you know, Lana, like you said, she's coming in and out of the room.
Yeah.
She's just like she has his entire life this last week. He starts listing off everything and the camera sticks on Cruz looking at her and her looking at Joel. And at the very end of it, right before he delivers that line, she walks away and behind her is like a picture of like his freshman year.
Yeah.
And it literally is. If you were to ask the kid in the picture, like, what's your life going to be like? He would never in a million years envision that he would be in the room with the guy who might get him into Princeton with his prostitute girlfriend.
Totally.
Like, he's so far away from the world that he should be. It's such a wonderful little piece of direction. And then the funniest line in the movie happens.
Take it away.
And she comes back in. She goes, how's it going in here, guys? He pulls out his Ray-Bans. Mm-hmm. He pulls out his cigarette. And he's like, sometimes you just got to say, what the fuck? And make your move. And of course, Lana, not missing a beat, walks in.
Yep.
How's it going in here, guys? And he stands up with the legendary Tom Cruise smile and says, looks like it's the University of Illinois. And then they just hold on
him.
Yeah,
that was interesting. He does two takes. Yeah.
Yeah, he does like this like head turn. And it's literally every scene of him getting out of a jet and Top Gun is that face.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like it is the face that like has carried him.
That's what Tony Scott said. That's my guy.
100%.
That's my guy. Back to real quickly when Lana was watching him, you could tell that she had a lot of respect for him as well and his own world that he had achieved, you know, that she didn't take that route. And although it may not have been Ivy League, Bill Rutherford meant it that he'd done some good work because, Joel, you know, he's in the 80 percentile and, you know, he's doing stuff. He's going to get into a university, even if it's just University of Illinois. Yeah.
Within both of their worlds, they have achieved a lot, you know, going different directions, but they definitely have achieved a lot.
Absolutely. And he's cool with it. You know, hey, I gave Princeton a shot. Wasn't meant to be.
Yep.
Even if this wasn't going on and it wasn't the one night in my life that this house is a brothel, Princeton interview would have gone the same.
Yeah. So it would have gone, it probably would have gone worse.
It probably would have gone worse.
Because he would have been so uptight about it and trying to impress him. And in reality, he's almost as cool as a cucumber.
Yeah. Even when they started the conversation or the meeting, there's knocks at the window. Hey, can I get him? He's from Skokie. He's got to be home. Can you get him in? Yeah. He's like,
he's got to be home by midnight. Yeah. It's so good.
Now Joel has resigned to play with his train set. It's later in the evening. Yep. And I always see this movie and I think it's the attic, but I guess it could be the basement. But whatever it is, there's also like a pool table in the background.
Yeah, you hear pool
keys. There's an old rocking horse. And so Joel always had nice toys, but, and Lana comes in to kind of cheer him up. And I like the train set, you know, I've never had one. I think it's very cinematic. And as you said earlier, and we both talked about, trains have a lot to do in this movie. They're constantly taking us places, and obviously it's leading us to something. The movie started on the train. Tangerine Dream wrote a song about it. But it's also a very controlled environment. And he's sitting there just controlling the thing. He's making the dog go back and forth, the person. And, you know, he's controlling this because right now his life is out of control. And, you know, and maybe, just maybe, he's making enough money to solve one of his big problems. But yeah, he's just kind of in his own world. I mean, this is the night of nights. He's the king of kings. And Lana comes in to cheer him up, which is really nice and thoughtful. And they really have a nice, they have great chemistry, which we haven't really talked about too much, but they really do.
I mean, this scene is the crux of the movie, quite honestly. It's the, you know, the train motif, like, you know, we've mentioned these two characters coming from very different worlds. The only thing that connects these two worlds in the real world is the trains. And there he is playing with what was probably his dad's train set,
I think so,
honestly.
Too.
And, you know, he's playing adult, right? He's this whole time he's playing adult. He immediately is starting to regret maybe an opportunity to get into Princeton that he just threw away. And she comes in, and Joel has, you know, always been somewhat of an open book. So it's the first time she shows him.
Yes.
You know, and he asks her point blank, are you my girlfriend? Yes, no, or maybe. And she does what she does so well.
So good.
She returns the dialogue right back at him and she says, yes. And you're like, and the way she says it, you're like, this is amazing. And then she goes, no, maybe. And she goes over and they start making out. And she's literally like,
well, then you hear his dad, Joel. Because he's on the phone.
He's on the phone.
Yeah.
It's a
great sequence. And you're right. Because to see her be Joel's girlfriend.
Yes.
We want to see her change, you know. Because by the way, we should also tell anyone who's not seen this movie, and you should see this movie before you listen to this podcast, but Lana was not one of the call girls that night. She was working, you know, everything.
That's right.
Her,
she's the
Barry,
madam of the house.
Madam of the house. She's not one of them. I mean, Vicky's probably working because we know her a little bit.
Sure.
But yeah, not her. She's really exclusive with Joel.
To Joel.
Since she's met him.
And, you know, while he's talking to his parents, who are wearing a tuxedo and an evening gown in their hotel wherever they are, you know, she's whispering in his ear, have you ever made love on a train? She's putting herself out there with him, like, this is something I've always wanted to do with someone special, and you are that special guy. I want to make love to you on a train. And again, it's crossing all the worlds. The parents being on the phone is a brilliant writtenly move, and the mom getting, you know, the dad's concerned that there's a party, and the mom gets on there, the phone's like, let me handle this, and is like, just use your best judgment. Just use your best judgment.
Yeah, what is dad's like, I don't remember giving permission for a party, Joel. You know, little do they know. And also, Brian, just to bring it back to reality, surely a neighbor at some point in time is going to say to Mr. and Mrs. Goodson, why, that was one big party you guys threw back in, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, they have no idea that there's hundreds of kids coming. But I'm sure at some point in time they'll know, but it'll be too late. Anyway, it is beautiful the way it's handled and crafted. And that leads to the party's over. And the girls are exhausted. I like that shot at like three of them just kind of zonked out on each other. And Joel and Lana head out. They first go to Banquet on a Bun. I guess it's like a fancy hot dog place. Looks kind of cool.
I guess.
And then they go to the L train with the iconic Phil Collins track, In the Air Tonight, playing.
You bet. You bet.
And so they're on the train, and slowly but surely, as they sit there looking at each other, waiting with this song is one of the greatest songs of all time, first of all. And definitely cinematic as anything. So great on Miami Vice. So great in this. It was also great in The Hangover. The song is amazing. And people are slowly exiting the train. And then there's one last person on the train.
And he knows what's up.
Yeah. Oh, he know. He ain't leaving. He's got a front row seat.
Yeah.
He's not going anywhere. And so Joel has to help him off the train. And the music fades out. And then comes Tangerine Dream's opus, Love on a Real Train, Risky Business.
Yep.
And that sets up what happens. And if we thought their first sex scene was a music video, well, then this is a whole other.
Yeah.
This is almost like another dream sequence. He did these in a way. They're very dreamy and very surreal and just, I don't even know. It's an incredible sequence and seductive.
It's the crescendo of the film. I mean, it's the two worlds completely colliding and they're on the same level. You know, and for the first time in the film, they're on the same level. They respect each other. And, you know, you could even dare to say that they're in love with each other in that moment.
Yeah. I even read that Brickman had initially done this where it is more of a dream and the train is flying in the air and they tried it.
Just
wasn't working. And I'm glad whatever was going on, they peeled it back because this says it all.
Yeah. And it's a music video without being it's a music ridiculous. Video. Yeah. But, you know, a flying train, I don't think that works.
So. Now we cut to Joel driving the Porsche home at 2 miles an hour.
Well, he's picked it up.
He's got it. He picked it up from the shop. It's perfect.
And right when he pulls out, he almost gets hit by a truck.
That was hilarious. And he's going so slow. He's got the hazards on. Kids are passing him on bikes.
Bikes. Yep.
Yeah, it's really great. Makes it home. And I love when he comes in his house, Brian. I love that he's whistling in the air tonight.
Yes, you know? Which is very meta, honestly, right?
Very meta. And he's got money in his hands because he's paid for the car. All's good. All's right. I'm a winner. I got a girlfriend. But Brian, what is revealed?
Guido raises his ugly little head again, and Joel is completely fucked because the entire house, he thinks his egg is missing. Now the entire interior of the house is gone.
Unbelievable.
It's all gone.
Unbelievable. Like, I remember seeing this for the first time and just, I was in disbelief. Like, how do you even do that? Yeah, Guido came in with or without the help of Vicky or anybody else, I don't know, and put everything in a moving van. Like a Ryder truck, and held it hostage.
Yep.
And drove all the way back to the city because Joel starts calling him, panicking. And
he calls Lana's apartment and he picks up.
And then, of course, they get into it and he's starts to cuss at him. And Guido's got the upper hand, man. He doesn't have to take it.
He holds all the cards. And it's a really funny scene because every time Joel gets upset, he just hangs up on him. And there's nothing he can do. There's nothing he can do.
The stakes are also raised again. You know, the tension, if you will, is because the parents are getting back this day.
It cuts to the airport and they're there curbside waiting for Joel to pick them up. He isn't there.
He knows they get in at 3:30 and it's already 4:15.
So there's some talk about this online that I guess every time he talks about his parents getting back, he says Sunday.
Yeah.
But when they actually call, they tell him that he will Saturday. He is taken off guard. Like, I mean, it is like, but does he know that they're coming back? I mean, I guess he doesn't, right?
No. I think that, so here's what happened. She said Saturday on that first call. After that, on that one phone call where she gets muffled and they're starting to make out, we don't get back into it. We don't talk about this again until they show up. And when they show up and they get to the house, they start talking about the date. They no longer say Friday or Saturday, Sunday. They start saying 6th and 5th, 5th and 6th. Mm. So I don't think he knew they were coming home. He wouldn't have been rushing like that.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
So he's rushing.
It's a mad dash.
He knows
it's
they're coming dash. And he jumps in the seat, you know, just like that scene in Weird Science when the house gets put back together at the end, the parents walk in, that last thing slides up. He jumps in the seat. And it's like, oh, hey guys. He knew they were coming home on Saturday the 5th, not Sunday the 6th. But it was smart in his mind to just play it that way. That's how I see it.
I think you're right.
So everything's gone. And this whole sequence is just hilarious.
Yeah,
you know, I know it's a bit farcical and over the top, but the movie, you know, you got to kind of sum this up somehow.
Well, he basically backs up that Ryder truck, like you said, and he's sitting on the gate on the back in a chair, and Vicky is bringing every item to the front, and all that money that he earned the night before, he has to buy back everything from the house. And it's a constant negotiation of like, oh, you like music? And there's his dad's stereo and the infamous equalizer.
Guido knows what he made, what he pocketed, because he 100%. Also knows the girls got paid. He didn't take the girls' money back.
No,
he's taking the house's money minus the repairs for the car.
Which should have been his money.
It kind of reminded me, Brian, of the old Wheel of Fortune when they had to buy prizes.
Yes, it's very Wheel of Fortune.
I'll take the ceramic dog for $200 and I'll have he'll take everything. And it just adds another moment of stall tactics, tension building.
Yep. Because the parents are getting in a cab at this point.
They're coming close. Yeah, they're in a cab. And I like how just annoyed they are. Like the dad's just like,
oh, they're so annoyed. They're not even worried that their son didn't pick him up from the airport. Like he may be hurt.
No, Joe obviously messed up. A single child, they never could blame anything on anyone else.
That's true.
So you said that earlier, but it's true. And it's like, they're always there. They're always the whipping boy, you know? So
that's right. Joel is their fault.
He could have been hijacked, but no, Joel's messed up. Joel has made a mistake. So, but this leads to this infamous crystal.
That's right. Egg. The last item on the truck.
And so what occurs here?
You know, basically Guido, he's at, you know, Vicky's the one bringing all the stuff to the front. She's like, oh, we've got this one last thing. They pull out the egg, the thing that he's been chasing the entire time. And he's only got $50. And he goes, I can't let it go for that, Joel. So how about he goes $340 because I know he goes, you'll owe me $300. He goes, how about you owe me $300? Which is, if you remember, he never actually paid Lana the $300 in the beginning because she left the house when he goes to do the bond.
That's right. She took
the egg. So Guido is getting his $300. Like he's it all goes back
and
to
Joel's
that original
getting the
300.
Egg back.
And Joel's getting the egg.
Because he's
and
not so, had the egg back this whole time.
That's correct.
The egg was never brought back.
Going back to what I was talking about earlier about Vicky being in the background, there's this wonderful shot. They're standing outside the truck negotiating. She's holding the egg and she's up in the truck and she like kneels down and she's perfectly between them. And it's kind of like, you know, they're negotiating over the egg, but in reality, they're negotiating over sex. I mean, this is what the whole movie's been about. And there she is, the prostitute with the egg. You get to keep your world. Like, I will give you Vicky. Just give me the egg back and I will keep my world and you can keep yours. And they come to this deal and then she tosses it like a goddamn football across the
yard. Yeah, she does. She bends down and like flings it. And like of all things to do, I mean, yes, why do that? Vicky's cool, but it just adds to the scene.
Oh, it's the drama.
You know, he's running, he's jumping over furniture, stepping on the piano. He's pulling out all the right moves here, Brian.
He really is. That's a good point. Yeah, he really is.
Although he was a linebacker in that movie, but still he's showing his football IQ and he makes a miraculous, very Julian Edelman type catch because he's a short white guy.
Good job. You know?
But he catches it and it doesn't even pass out of his
Wes Welker. Wes Welker. Another Oklahoma reference.
Texas Techer. That's right. I love how Guido calls it the artsy fartsy thing. The artsy fartsy thing?
I can't let the artsy fartsy thing go for
$40. Not for $40. You're good for it? Okay. So I love that. And I also like, after he makes the catch, Guido's sitting on a chair in the back of the Ryder truck.
As it drives away.
With a beer and driving away. Now, surely he's not going to stay there, but what a great effect that is for him just to leave, just to drive a little bit out of frame was amazing.
Yeah, and you hear the crack of the beer, you know, that's a whole running thing throughout this. People are either smoking. Every time we see Lana, she's got like a coffee cup in her hand.
Oh, yeah.
She's constantly drinking coffee. All the outside characters except for Joel are constantly doing some kind of vice.
Yeah,
And yeah, as he drives away, he cracked. It's like Miller time for him.
Yeah.
And he got every cent that Joel had. Yeah. Matter of fact, he owes him $300.
Yeah. So he's, you know, he has a parting wave and some advice and they're out. And Joel is in full panic mode. Barry's there. Another friend that was at the original diner scene is helping him, and they're putting everything inside and going very quick. And I like that Barry even takes a moment, like he kind of wants to redirect the knickknacks.
The wrong centuries.
Yeah, I wouldn't mix centuries. This. Like, no, it has to be the way it is. It can't be the way you want it. And then, of course, like all teen movies, the parents arrive, and we already talked about he jumps over the little love seat or whatever.
Sure. And he's just made it. He's
just pulled it off.
Or has he?
And the mom comes in, and you know, once he explains things, and you know, hey, dad, they're going to help with the luggage. Okay, great. But the mom, of course, she goes in, Brian. And what is the first thing that she does?
She turns on the light underneath the crystal egg. And now I am so disappointed in you, Joel.
Immediately, like this meticulous household, and she spots this crack, this little crack that it could be microscopic, and she's going to spot it.
We don't even see it. They never show it.
She checks this crystal egg every day. She finds such great joy in it. And of course, there's a crack, and she knows that Joel had company.
How could this have happened, Joel?
I don't know.
That's what you keep saying. I don't know. How could this have happened?
I mean, the egg was at Lana's for a week, and then, and then I did catch it across the lawn.
Little do they know how the adventures of the egg.
He's just thinking, you're lucky that egg's even there. But Joel will pay for it. You know, this is a single child getting in trouble. It's already been decided.
There's even a nice little moment with the father as she walks up. The mom walks up the stairs, and she's outraged.
She'll be okay.
He's like, listen, she'll be okay. You'll just have to beef up your lawn work, which basically means I'm just going to go fucking buy another one of these stupid eggs and we'll figure it out. Don't worry about it.
So Joe goes back to doing yard work, but this time he has a little bit more swagger to him. And what happens?
His dad comes out and you think he's about to get in trouble that the cat's out of the bag.
Well, because he also smoked a cigarette.
Oh yeah, he lights up. Yeah, he's got the Ray-Bans on as the leaves blow. A really nice cinematic shot as we cross the lawn towards him for his close up, and you know, he's got his swagger. Like he's the man, and he's pulled it off. Like crack or no crack, he honestly has pulled it off. Yeah. Like he's a completely different person than he was at the beginning of this movie. And as he's putting all the yard tools away, he closes the shed. And there's his dad standing there with this kind of like, you can't really tell if he's upset or if he's happy or what's going on.
That was a great reveal, like, by the way.
It really was a good reveal. And it's, you know, it's like a scare tactic. Yeah. It's like a horror movie. It's like, oh shit, he hasn't gotten away with it. And he basically, is there something you should tell me, son? You know, that dreaded, like, it's like, no, I don't think so, dad.
That was old Joel creeping back in there too.
It kind of was. And then, you know, we get another one of these amazing lines where it's like, I just got off the phone with, the dean of admissions, and he said, Princeton can use a guy like Joel. And, you know, you see Joel's face, and he's just like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what? Of course, you know, the audience can fill in the blanks that, you know, the dean of admissions had a really, really good time at that party. And his dad goes in for the hug, and Joel is completely shocked that, you know, no matter, you know, what road he took, he ended up achieving all of his goals.
Yeah. I love that his dad also said, haven't I been telling you every once in a while, you've got to say what the heck and take some chances. Yeah. His dad's version was a little bit more PG.
The clean version. But it's a wonderful, I mean, listen, this is like the second to last scene in the film, and it's a wonderful callback, and it really is. It's a nice father-son moment, and it's true. Once you hear the father say that to him, you're like, everyone in his life had been telling him that he needed to kind of go, he needed to have this transition, you know, this transformation. Yeah. And he did it.
And he's made his dad
proud. Better off for it.
He's better for it. He's a better man. He's more prepared, well prepared for the world. And you can see the bond between them is strong, and his mother too. Yeah. She's upset right now, and rightfully so. But yeah, they love him and they love his achievements, and he did it. He achieved the impossible. Had he not grown and done this, He wasn't getting into Princeton.
He was not getting into Princeton.
He was not. And his dad would have been like, you know what? Okay. He didn't live up to the legacy. It's okay. Joel's a great kid. But now he did. And his dad's more proud of him than we'll ever know. That hug, that the long hug says it all. You know?
It really does.
Now, this is the last scene in the movie in the highly debated scene with Paul Brickman, but we have Joel and Lana again. And I like this scene.
I do too.
It's the next sequence. This is kind of a two-parter. So Joel and Lana are meeting for lunch and like more as adults, Brian. I mean,
oh, 100%. They are contemporaries in the new world, right? Because the you see two other tables, and what's those two other tables?
Business.
There's all these older white gentlemen doing business, and the two of them are sitting down and they're talking through their business.
Yep. And so they're catching up. And this is before he's going to go off to school. And by the way, let's just set the stage. It's a really nice place. You don't really get a sense of how beautiful it is because in the ending that was cut by Paul, you know, Paul Brickman's initial ending showed the beautiful shot of the lake and how picturesque it was. But in this ending, that's omitted. You just know that they're catching up, they're talking.
And they're talking about their future. They're talking about where do you think we'll be in 10 years? And they both kind of are like, yeah, I think, you know, she says that. I think we're going to be in a really good place.
We're going to make it.
You know, he turns the table a little bit and he basically just come flat out asks her, was this whole thing a setup?
Yeah.
And, you know, she does what she does so wonderfully. Every time he tries to push too far, she kind of leans back and just looks out that window.
Yeah.
And then they start cutting in the future enterprises, you know, the students getting up there and talking about how much money their products made.
Yeah, exactly. And it's
wonderfully cut. It's cut between the scene of the restaurant and then going to this kind of like mythical club where everyone's kind of bragging about how their products made so much money.
Well, it's a real club. That was where he would belong to that.
No, it is. It's a real club, but I don't know if, you know, that scene seems to be in Joel's head a little
bit. Who knows if him and Barry even succeeded at Memo Minder?
Sure. You never know.
I think he actually, like that one girl, like, I made this much. Yeah, everyone's kind of recapping what they made, how much they made. I think that really happened. It's just in his head. And then and they're walking through the park. It looks like the same park in which the Porsche goes in Lake Michigan. And they're kind of strolling and they're being very playful about hanging out that night. But then the VO comes on, says, my name is Joel Goodson. I deal in human fulfillment. I grossed over $8,000 in one night. Time of your life, huh, kid?
Time of your life, huh, kid?
Says it all.
It really does. And right before and that's when it cuts to black. But right before that, in the park, as they're walking,
right.
They repeat the dialogue they had earlier when they were negotiating.
Yeah.
He's like, but she's the one. I only have $50. Like, what are we going to do about this? And she's like, can I write you a check? And, you know, it's kind of showing how the tables have turned. And that is the ending that was forced upon Brickman to, you know, it's kind of a happy ending because you think, oh, they actually are together. But in the alt, you know, in the alt inning, it never leaves that restaurant.
Never leaves the restaurant.
And he power plays her. Like he tells her to come here and she gets up and sits in the chair next to him. And he's like, no, come here. And she like goes and sits in his lap and it's very ambiguous. I mean, you think that obviously they're together, but are they really together? And they never answer the question if this whole thing was just a con. Like that even in the Hollywood ending is still kind of ambiguous. Yeah. You really just don't know.
You're absolutely right. Now, and in the ending that was cut, that's when you pull back and get a high shot of them and she's sitting in his lap and they're embracing.
Yeah.
And it ends, so you don't get this park sequence. Now, all we've ever known, Brian, as lovers of this film, is the ending. The ending as we know
it.
And I have no problem at all with the ending. I see that.
I don't either.
I see them.
I don't
meet.
Either.
I see them as adults. I've seen that they've grown. I see that they have a respect for each other. But no way, shape, or form did I ever think they were going to be together.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Jason. I feel like while it may be a little bit more ambiguous with, you know, the restaurant scene with her sitting in the lap, the park scene it's not like they're holding hands or getting married. Like, while it may be a little more romantic comedy, it's still ambiguous. They still come from very different worlds.
Yeah.
And once he goes off
he's
to college,
he's going off to school and she's learned a lot and she probably has already changed. I can see her. You know, maybe she's still an escort or, you know, doing jobs, but selectively and looking for her out. That's what I see. And And they're playful there, and that's how they started their rapport.
Yeah, so, and it's a callback to the beginning of the movie, which the scene with the father before does the same thing.
So I liked it. I think...
Yeah, I did too. I liked
it. He probably didn't like it as much, but it's still a pretty damn good ending.
It's you know, it's not as far off base as you would think. When you hear that there's an alternate ending, I watched it on YouTube last night, and I was like, oh, that's really not much different.
Was the VO in the...
that you read happens when she's sitting in his
that's
lap,
right.
and it cuts.
Yeah.
To that.
That's right.
It cuts to that wide shot. And, you know, again, in the alternate ending in that wide shot, you see the beautiful Lake Michigan. It's the beauty of downtown Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't always have to be as grimy because they've come to this ivory tower. But what's so great is, again, you look at the two tables at their bookend and it's two old white men on either side having business meetings.
Exactly.
And here's this kid with this hot prostitute sitting in his lap. They're not adults yet.
No.
You know what I'm saying? They're still, you know, and I'm sure that's part of it that doesn't come out in that park walking scene in the original ending, but it's not lost on you.
No.
It's not that far. Like I said, it's not that far off base and it's still a great movie. Nonetheless.
If you ever revisit it and made a sequel, you could see what happened to them in life, but no way would I ever say, yeah, Joel and Lana got married. No, Joel went off to Princeton and probably met someone and Lana is probably thriving, running businesses and had a family of her own. That's it. I truly believe they came together. They became better because they met and they learned from each other and they went on and had better lives. I mean, this is such a powerful film. We're still talking about a movie from 1983.
Almost 30 years.
Today. And it still works. You know, it's like a great book.
Yeah.
Picking up a classic. I mean, this is a modern day classic for us. But
yeah, I mean, it's like every movie you're going to do a podcast about. Like, it took a lot of talented people had to come together to make it. And I mean, if you look at the poster, you're like, oh, it's just another teen sex comedy.
Exactly.
That's not what it is.
No.
That's not what it is. It is a serious coming of age. It's an 80s version of The Graduate, and it's really well done.
And that's what I like about movies in general, because they are really capturing an era that we'll never see. So to go back and visit this part of 80s, the economic landscape with Reagan. And yeah, it's amazing just to go put myself in that for an hour and a half and visit it. And listen, to this day, I still play the soundtrack. And typically now I just play the Tangerine Dream songs. And on YouTube, there's even a couple of people have posted tracks that didn't even make it on the soundtrack that are in the movie, like the Watering the Lawn never made it on the soundtrack, but that is now a Tangerine Dream track online. Good for creative times when you're looking to go deep into things. So that is it. End of the trivia, very quick, and we'll wrap it up. We've already given one of these away. We already talked about my first trivia, which was the film was originally called White Boys Off the Lake. Paul Brickman changed it because the studio said it sounded like an off-Broadway play.
Yeah, and it does.
White guys it's not off a good the title. Lake. Na 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 na. It's hilarious.
I mean, I don't even know what that means. I mean, I do know what it means, but it's not a good title.
No.
It's not a good title.
I'm always interested to see who could have been in a role, you know, or who passed on it. So Timothy Hutton and Rob Lowe both turned down the role of Joel Goodson.
Oh, really? Wow. And Rob Lowe was in
Outsiders.
Was in The Outsiders. So Tom Cruise had connections to both.
Well, they
guys.
Both could have done it. You know, they have the look, they have the chops. But again, I think Cruise was perfect. Now here's others: John Cusack, Nicolas Cage, Michael J. Fox, Tom Hanks, and Sean Penn all auditioned for the role.
Huh. I mean, Sean Penn would have crushed it as well. Tom Hanks, I think it would have been more funny. Like, I mean, he just would have brought a much more funny energy to
same
it.
Same like with Cusack and Fox.
But Nicolas Cage would have brought something completely different.
He would have made up a weird voice.
And this isn't crazy Nicolas Cage. This is like moonstruck Nicolas Cage, you know, like he would have brought something very different.
He would have done
it.
Like a voice like in Peggy Sue Got Married. He would have done something like a really high pitched thing. Now, Brian Backer from Fast Times Ridgemont High, he played Mark Rat Ratner. He was actually cast and then replaced.
Oh, really?
So there he went to that stage.
Huh. So when this hit and Tom Cruise became a movie star, he must have been like, mother.
Yeah, but it's Tom Cruise. So, you know.
Sure, but you're always like, that was my part and I lost it.
Sure. Sure, because I can't name another movie that Backer was in who was fantastic in Fast Times.
Yeah. I mean, at least Eric Stoltz rebounded from not being in Back to the Future. That's a tough one.
Although he also was in Fast Times. but that's a whole other
Yes, he was. That's
all
right.
Connected, Brian.
They all come from Fast Times.
So next, Brooke Shields and Kim Basinger both turned down the role of Lana.
Which is surprising because Kim Basinger wouldn't have any issues with the nudity. Now,
she didn't like the script, though, is what I read.
She didn't like the script. I can see reading this off the page, it may, because you think, again, you're reading a teen comedy and you're like, where are the jokes? Yeah. Like, this isn't fun.
She looks the part. Would they have had the chemistry? I don't know. Like, that's something.
I think she would have crushed it.
I think she would have.
I think she would have crushed it, honestly.
But I'm glad that was Rebecca De Mornay.
She was really good at like shutting down and just expressing what's going on in her head through her face and without using words. Yeah. I don't know if Kim Basinger could have pulled that part out. I mean, Kim Basinger would have brought the heat. Yeah. I don't know if she would have had. And it's so funny because I look at Rebecca De Mornay like the rest of her career and it's like she hasn't had a bad career, but I don't feel like she's ever had a part as good as this, you know?
I agree with you. This was probably her best part. She was really good in The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, but
I mean, yeah, that was like a movie star making role as well, but she didn't have to do what she did in this film.
Now, a little tidbit. At the party scene, you see Jason Gedrick.
Yes,
Iron Eagle.
That's who it was in the back. Yes. Yeah. Barely see him.
Well, yeah. Cruz walks right by and he smiles.
He walks by him. But then a girl swishes him away. I didn't know that. That's exactly who that was. Iron Eagle.
Iron Eagle. And then Megan Mullally played one of the call girls.
Oh, I'm going to have to go back.
And of course, she's in Will and Grace. And
sure.
Many other things, but I'm just quickly throwing this in. Last but not least, Nicolas Cage.
Whoa, Fast Times again.
He's also the party scene and he's an extra. And you see him make a little, like a funny little walk and a head bob.
You see his walk.
And you see him. It's clear as day.
Oh my God.
I got on there and took the screen grabs.
It's so funny about Nicolas Cage. Like he literally just hung out. He was just
hung out.
He's in like so many movies in the background before he like became famous. Yeah. It's crazy.
They're all buddies.
They're all buddies.
He was friends with Tom Cruise, and he was probably friends with Sean Penn. And let's go visit Tom. He's on set making this. They didn't know what they were making, Brian.
That's very
true. You know, like, you're going to be in Chicago? Yeah, I got this gig. This Brat Pack was just all over, and they weren't big yet. Cruise wasn't big yet. Yeah, pop by, say hello. I'll be in Chicago for a couple months. So, yeah, it's kind of cool. I love that they have the wherewithal just to, I'll be in that scene. What do I care?
Yeah, exactly.
And here he is. The Ray-Ban Wayfarer sunglasses that Tom Cruise wears, which are amazing and iconic, Brian, as you know.
Yes, iconic, yes.
Had a 2,000% increase in sales after the movie's release.
I mean, again, it's on the poster. Like, it's like his eyes and the Ray-Ban, the Porsche, and her laying on top of it. Like, it's all you need, right? The poster itself is an ad.
I love that ad. Yeah, for Porsche and Ray-Bans. Sorry.
It's an ad, right? Like if you have the car, if you have the glasses, you can have the girl.
That's it.
That isn't the 80s, I don't know what.
Yeah.
What is?
But that is it. An incredible movie. It was so fun to have you on this podcast. And
oh man, it was a real joy. And you know, one last thing for me that I just want to say is the film's great. Obviously we've doted on it for the last few hours here. The one real sad thing is that he didn't make more movies. I mean, that's like it launched Cruise. It even launched all the actors in this movie. They all went on to have a great decade of success. But Brickman never came close to this, and it really is unfortunate that again, we said this earlier, it didn't seem to mind him, but I feel like we've lost something. I feel like we could have had other risky business type movies. We just have to enjoy what he did give us, and this one's a great one.
No, and you're so right with that. I used to say that about Kubrick. He had huge gaps, and that was, in reading one of his books, that was one of his regrets. Like, it took 12 years there. I didn't make enough movies. Anything we got from Kubrick is amazing, and we'll look at it and examine it forever. But yeah, we're greedy. We want more of that.
Sure.
You and I and other film lovers would love to watch 5 more movies similar in tone, in very different topics that Paul Brickman created. Yes, that's the greedy side of us. We'd love to see it because he's capable. Not many directors can pull off these types of feats, and the great ones do it a lot.
Yeah, you know? I feel like John Hughes basically took what maybe he started and had a career with it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. And you know what? Hey, Brian, maybe Brickman still is.
True. Yeah.
Maybe he's got another opus in him, another great film in him. I hope that I have the luxury to talk to him at some point in time and answer that question about the, yes, go ahead.
Did she put the Porsche in neutral on purpose or not?
And then lock the door.
And then lock the door.
Stop. Now you're totally convinced. So thanks so much for listening. And please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcast. You can also follow us on social media at Let's Talk Movies or check out our other shows at justcuriousmedia.com. So without further ado, please enjoy
Risky Business.